This is tape number 3 in the oral history of Griffith University, and the interview is with Professor Colin McCurris. Good afternoon, Colin.
Good afternoon, Patience.
When Griffith University was established, you were one of the early professional appointments, in fact, the second in what was then the School of Modern Asian Studies. In what year was this? How did the appointment come about? And what was your first contact with Griffith?
And I was appointed, I took up the appointment as a foundation professor at the very beginning of 1974, January the 1st to be precise. I had come to Griffith before, in 1973 obviously, for interviews. And I was one of four people who became professors then, one in each of the four schools. And I saw the advertisement in the newspaper. I thought it would be worth applying because I was attracted to the idea of coming to a new university and having an input into the setting up of the courses and the general idea of the university. I found it very attractive. Oh. My first actual contact was with when I came up for appointment, which was in 1973, and I had an interview, I talked to the then Vice-Chancellor, Professor Willett, and Ted Bray. I remember those two very clearly, and Hoping Yoke. There were a number of others as well that were on the interviewing panel. But my first recollection, earliest recollection, was of going to Toowong, where the university was housed at that time, and having dinner with Hoping Yoke, who was somebody I already knew and very much loved and admired, although I got to know him much better later, of course.
Yes.
And going to his house there and talking about the sorts of courses that we might set up, in effect planning the whole thing. He told me even at that stage, I knew that I would be offered the appointment. Mm-hmm. So we began to plan very early in the piece about that.
Oh. Absolutely essential, I imagine,
absolutely.
With the start of a new university and with a school which is, unique as School of Modern Asian Studies.
That's right, and especially at that time it was very quite unique.
Yes. Mm. Well, the people that you came in contact with in those early days was Professor Willett and Professor Hoping Yoke.
Right.
And Sir Theodore Bray.
And their wives, of course.
And
their wives, of course.
Yes.
Jean Willett has remained a long-term friend of mine as well.
Yes, she's a wonderful woman.
Oh, she sure is.
She was a sort of mother to the university, wasn't she?
Yes.
In many, many ways.
Absolutely.
Hmm. Where was your first office located?
My first office was located in the office in Toowong, in High Street Toowong.
Uh-huh.
It was in a building that had a lot of other places as well, other organisations. Shortly after I came to Griffith, there was a very big flood. That was I remember being in the High Street office then.
Uh-huh.
That was the January 74
yes.
flood, an enormous, the biggest flood we've
terrible
ever had.
One, yes.
Yeah, that was really, really awful. Shortly after that, we moved to Salisbury, mm-hmm. where there was an office, which was not very nice, actually. It was, very very temporary. It was a warehouse in Salisbury, that's right.
So Theodore was telling me about that.
And I had an office there, right in the middle, without even a window. I don't look back on that with great pleasure, I must say. That was during the latter half of 74.
Mm.
And then in early 75, when we actually started teaching, we moved into the present campus and have been here ever since.
The School of Modern Asian Studies was an article of faith of the founding Chancellor, Sir Theodore Bray, who strongly believed Australia must learn more about the people and the countries of Asia. How did you go about setting up the programs and the courses? And which was the first?
Well, we shortly after I arrived, I began to plan, together with Hoping Yoke, a series of courses, the first being the foundation course. That was one of the ideas of the Griffith University in those early days, and it still remains so to this day.
Mm.
One of the early appointments that we had included Dr. Colin Brown.
Oh, yes.
And Dr. Edmund Fung then, who's the present dean of AIS,
yes.
And a number of others, they came in the very early days. And together with them, Hoping Yoke was a bit less active after they came, and he was quite happy to let me plan a lot of the social science courses in the first in the foundation, mm-hmm. the first year there. We had a series of meetings. I'll never forget them, actually. Some of them were in the Salisbury office. Right. Many of them we came out to this campus for. And I remember going down to a place that's now the gymnasium.
Oh, yes.
And we met there. We planned it. We had a lot of very healthy debates, very big arguments. And, I mean, I look back on it with great pleasure, those times, actually.
Creative period.
Oh, very creative. And we planned out the first foundation course, mm-hmm. which I, looking back on it, I still think was a good course. I mean, the present one is enormously different. It's undergone very big changes. But we planned out the general structure of the courses then for first, second and third year. We planned out the foundation course. We mounted materials that we could give to the students. I was the convener of the foundation course for the first few years. Mm-hmm. So it fell on me to do most of the major planning and organising the meetings and things like that, and chairing those meetings. Mm-hmm. And it was a very creative period. Mm-hmm. And when we first mounted the foundation course in 1975, there were a lot of problems with the course, but it was, I look back on, was very, very great commitment mm-hmm. on behalf of all the staff that we had there, and a real esprit de corps, which I must say I don't see as much in the later years.
Really? Oh, that's a pity.
It is a pity, but I mean, that's just my observation.
Yes.
Maybe it's... But I mean, I'm not wishing to anything that's happened since, obviously, but I do look back on a very substantial esprit de corps that is, you know, really quite a remarkable phenomenon.
And very important, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Was there any order of priority in the countries to be studied?
Well, that was one of the things we had some argument about.
Oh, yes.
In the first year of language teaching, we offered only Chinese. That was partly because of the staffing question and partly because the appointment of the language to the director of the language centre was made quite late.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the reality. And we tried to make the foundation course reflect all countries equally. But I do know that the Indonesian scholars, especially Colin Brown, thought we were being too China-centred.
Mm-hmm.
I, as a China specialist, tried to avoid that, I must say. But because the first language to be offered was Chinese, and then the second year we offered both Japanese and Indonesian as well.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1976.
Yes, yes.
So I suppose that you could say we didn't want to have a priority of the countries to be studied, but because of the languages, we did, ipso, you know,
yes, that
tend
just
to
happened.
Give China the preference the first year.
And how important was the study of the languages of these countries?
Well, we thought it very important. Mm. In the beginning, and I think still now, actually, it's largely the same, although perhaps a little less of an emphasis. We wanted to make it compulsory for all students to carry the language right through. We quickly abandoned that.
Theodore says, unfortunately.
I know he does. I know he says that. That was the original idea, and we still insist that students do at least 1 year of language.
Mm-hmm.
In the first year, and the first few years, as a matter of fact, our system was to have no language in the first semester.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that being, and that was the same when you came,
yes,
the reason for that being that students could get some feeling for which country they found most interesting in the first semester, and on that basis decide which of the three languages they would take.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I still think, even now, that was a good idea.
Yes.
It's been abandoned in the faculty.
They begin straight away with a language.
They begin
the
straight
semester.
Away. They really have very little opportunity to find which language in country interests them most.
Mm.
But, I mean, they did run up against problems there, but I still think that basically it was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And we put a lot of emphasis on language. And the policy of the school was that language was you know, essential for an understanding of the country.
And the culture of the country, particularly, yes. Was it difficult to obtain teachers of Chinese, Japanese and Indonesian?
Now, that's one of the questions that it's not really... I'm not really the one to ask that, because I was not in charge of the language.
Oh, I see.
Well, Hoping Yoke wasn't either, really,
no,
because there was a language centre.
Yes.
And we had a...
When was that established, right?
That was established right at the beginning.
Right at the beginning, okay.
But then we changed policy and abolished the language centre. That was in 19...
About 81, 82... 81?
Yeah, about 81.
80,
yes,
81.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. It was in the early 80s.
It was discussed when I first went
on the
council.
That's right. We had a lot of debate about that. And so when the university was first established, there was a language centre. I don't recall hearing Terry Jordan, who was the director of the language centre, say whether there was a really difficult to find teachers of those languages.
No, okay.
But I do know we imported a lot of them. We got, for example, several of the Chinese ones were hired from Hong Kong, but Terry and Bob Dawson, who Bob, of course, is still here.
Yes.
And he came, he was an Australian.
And you said that the emphasis on the importance of the language has changed a little bit. But I don't imagine proficiency in an Asian language was taken into consideration in the awarding of a degree.
Well, if you passed... No, well, it's not only if you took the language. You had to pass language in the first year to go on.
I see.
Or we sometimes allowed what we call pass conceded.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of debate about that too. But you had to pass language. But once you got into the second year, if you took language and you passed it, and you got your 24 credit points, you would get your degree even if you didn't do that well in language.
I see.
Or even if you didn't take it even past the first year.
But do you still feel it's very important to concentrate on the language if it's at all possible?
Oh, yes.
Yes. Did the students have any prior knowledge of an Asian language before leading their studies at Griffith?
Mostly not. In the case of Japanese had been taught in secondary schools for some time, and some of our students did do Japanese at school. Chinese and Indonesian, very few indeed. In fact, one of the first things I did when I came here was to try and get Chinese introduced into the secondary schools. I think there's a question about that later on. So the short answer is that most of the students didn't, and of those that did, the great majority had done Japanese and were doing Japanese.
Yes. And was it difficult for students to cope with the study of the main courses at the university level while some of them were tackling the language at the elementary level? Or was it easier for them? Perhaps it was easier to do an elementary language if they didn't course in language if they didn't know any of the language, rather than to come in at a higher level?
They found that it was quite difficult because the language tended to take up a lot of the time.
Yes, I know.
And I remember many students, I think of whom you were one, complaining that the language swallowed up the great majority of their time.
I didn't complain because I loved it, but it did.
It certainly was a factor.
Yes, it took a great deal of time.
The thing about language is that you've got to be at it all the time. You can't take it up, drop it and take it up as you can with, say, history.
No.
It's very focused study.
If you leave it, you lose it.
If you leave it, you lose it, exactly. And you'll quickly forget it, and then you will find, you've lost a lot of time.
Yes.
But I think many of the students who were most interested in the main courses tended to let language go and vice versa. And it was certainly a struggle to keep both of them going. But, of course, the best students did succeed in all the areas. Of the learning.
And you had some very, very good students, didn't
Certainly
you?
We did, among whom you were one.
Oh, no, I was one of the mediocre
no,
ones.
No,
but I think
you
of
weren't.
A lot of people who went on particularly to do jobs in the diplomatic corps.
There were some,
ADAB and various
Some
other
of the early
agencies.
Students we had were very good, yes. Some of the later ones, of course, are also good, but no. I suppose it's... I still look back on the first few years with great affection.
What approximately was the percentage of school leavers and mature aid students enrolled in the early MAS courses?
I'm afraid I can't remember the proportions, but I do recall that we, in our early years, we made a policy of encouraging mature aid students because it was we thought it was a good thing to encourage people, you know, in their later life to get into a different mode of thinking and start a new career. And I still think that that was a very wise decision. A number of the best students that we had were indeed mature age students and had not school leavers. Some were young mature age students.
25s and
that sort of age. 30. That sort of age. Mm. But others were not. I mean, for example, one that comes to mind is Michael Dutton, whom you may remember.
Yes, indeed I do.
Michael Dutton was a young mature age student. He not only did a PhD later, but he's gone into the academic world, and he's just had a book out by the Cambridge University Press. Yes.
Really?
Based on his PhD thesis.
Isn't that splendid?
And he's done extremely well. Another was Paul Healy, whom I think may also remember.
Yes, indeed I do.
Now, Paul he was a bit idiosyncratic in some ways, it has to be said, but he's a brilliant mind. Oh. And he also has done very well in the academic world.
Yes.
And then, of course, there's you.
I remember Michael, who had, I think, at least two or three scholarships offered him to go to China.
That's right, he did.
And I talked to him when he came back, and I said, Michael, you were an anarchist at one stage, weren't you? And he grinned and he said, yes. And I said, are you still an anarchist? And he said, no. And I said, why not? And he said, I found it didn't work. He was always great fun at tutorials.
Mm. He's always full of ideas.
Full of ideas and would argue with the lecturer and, you know, really, very brilliant young man, I thought. Mm. I'm so glad that he's done so well.
Mm.
Whereabouts is he now?
He's at the University of Melbourne.
Is he?
Yep.
That's marvellous.
You say, what were the particular problems which mature age students... Now, I always felt, and I think I still feel, that mature age students had their particular strengths and school leavers had theirs. And weakness is the same. I think that the school leavers, they could remember better, and that made them better for them. They have more flexible minds in some respects, making it easier for them to learn languages from the beginning. But the mature age students have a better understanding of things. They could grasp major problems more readily.
Mm-hmm.
And that made them very good students for a great variety of ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, just talking about Michael again, for example, he did not do very well at language at Griffith University.
Didn't he?
No, he didn't. Oh. He mastered language after leaving because he got passionately interested in China.
Oh.
That happened while he was at Griffith University, and he got the scholarships, as you rightly said. And when he was in China, his language, you know, he was able to improve his language enormously, and to build on the knowledge that he'd got here at Griffith from the work that we did in Chinese studies.
I think one of our remarkable older mature age students was Eve Woodrow.
Yeah, that's right.
Because Eve not only did Chinese, but she then, after she graduated, went on, did a master's degree, and did Indonesian as a miscellaneous student. Remarkable.
She had her 80th birthday a couple of years ago.
Did she really? Yes, she would. Mm.
And unfortunately, she invited me to the party that she had, which I was unfortunately unable to go to because I was in China at the time.
Ah, yes.
But she was, as you say, remarkable.
The last project I heard her talking about, she was telling me on the telephone, actually, was that she was teaching a young Australian to read and write. Not a child, an adult, an illiterate lad to read and write. You know, I think that's a tremendous spirit to be doing that.
certainly is, yeah. Mm.
She used to give, of course, some English lessons to Chinese from Vietnam and all that sort of thing.
Maybe I could add here, although it's not exactly in direct answer to this, the question that we're asked, that we're talking about now. In addition to the foundation course, we had a series of a kind of skeleton of courses that were focused on particular countries. Mm-hmm. We had, for example, Chinese politics, which I took, mm-hmm. And you did,
yes.
I recall. Mm-hmm. We had Japanese economics and things of that sort. Mm. Then we had integrating courses, like Australia and Asia was one that we mm-hmm. had from the very early times. And mm-hmm. I remember, in fact, I was the first convener of that course. Mm. The one on Chinese politics, we did that first in 1977, and I have done it almost every year since then.
Have you really?
And although it has changed from time to time.
Yes, tremendously.
Because the politics, the subject has changed. The basic outline of that course is rather similar to what it was in the early days. I mean, I keep up to date, of course, with everything that's happening and pass that on to the students. But the basic skeleton of the course is roughly the same, and I still think it works very well.
Mm.
And then we had disciplinary courses like historiography, we didn't have political science in the very early days, actually. Mm. Economics and anthropology, we had those.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And
study of society, I know I did.
Yeah, we still have that even now. Mm. We still, that skeleton is for modern Asian studies is still like that, although there have been major changes as well, but that basic structure is still the same.
The International Business Studies, of course, is one of the courses that's taken off like a
that's
rocket.
That's right, yes.
In later years.
Yeah, in later years. That's just in the last 2 or 3 years that that's happened.
Yes. Do you think it's important for children to study foreign languages, especially Asian languages, at school? Now, I think you've got very strong opinions about this.
Yes, I have strong opinions about that. I certainly do. I think that that is something that has changed enormously in the last 2 years. Mm. But I recall when I came to Griffith in 1974, one of the first things I did was to try and get Chinese introduced into the schools, because there was no Chinese at the schools in Queensland then, none. Mm. And I remember having a great, great difficulty persuading people that this was a useful thing to do. They said, for example, the kind of objections they raised were there are no textbooks to use.
Aye, yes.
So in response to that, I got the Hanyu project going, and it's still going. I mean, it's been so long doing, but it is coming to fruition now.
It's now working throughout Australia, isn't it?
Indeed it is.
Yes.
It's
started by you in Queensland.
Yes, indeed.
And spread out throughout Australia.
I don't claim all of the credit for it, of course, but I certainly was the prime mover behind it.
Yes. And Alice, your wife.
Alice, yeah, she's still working on it, even now.
Mm.
And then they said, well, the timetables won't work. And I remember the timetables, of course, are very inflexible and very difficult things. But the basic thing was that people in those days just weren't convinced of the need to do languages. And languages were very much in a slough mm-hmm. in those days. One of the reasons was that they just relaxed the demand for doing languages as a prerequisite to enter the Faculty of Arts at the University of Queensland.
Mm-hmm.
That was just happening when I first came here.
Mm-hmm.
But nearly two decades since then, there's been quite a big shift in opinion concerning the need for languages, and Asian languages in particular. And if you look at the figures now, although Chinese and Indonesian are still behind French and German, Japanese is the front-running language in Queensland schools now.
Really?
Mm. Then German and French are almost the same.
Mm-hmm.
After that, Chinese and Indonesian and Italian are front-running languages.
It started off, didn't it, in the private schools, the Asian languages?
That's right.
And were you instrumental in getting it to Brisbane?
Well, I was, yes. I was...
Max Howell was there.
Max Howell was the headmaster of it.
Yes.
And he was a member of our council, and he elected to take it on and still going there.
With great success.
And that I think he did a very good thing to do that. I mean, that was quite pioneering in those days, but he took it on. And I mean, remember designing courses and all that sort of thing, and being on the Foreign Languages Advisory Committee, FLAC for short, and all that sort of thing. That was only for Chinese, of course. Then there was other work being done for Japanese and Indonesian. Joyce Ackroyd had been the pioneer in, as far as Japanese was concerned.
The University of Queensland.
At the University of Queensland. That is still relevant. I think that work is still relevant. I remember also having meetings in Melbourne, going down to Melbourne to have meetings to try and get a national thing going for Chinese. This was in 1974-75.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember striking very stout resistance at some stage this. But I think, looking back on it, I don't regret anything of what was done.
No.
And I think the Hanyu, I mean, if there hadn't been Hanyu, it really would have been very difficult for the whole thing to advance in the way that it has done.
Mm.
And although there's now a national curriculum, which has just been released, actually, a national curriculum for Chinese, which was...
Really?
Mm, just been released.
The Australian government?
Mm. Which was done by the Asian Studies Council.
Ah, yes.
It's a curriculum. It doesn't. It's not a course.
No.
So it doesn't replace Hanyu. There's been other work done, since then. But Hanyu is still a very valuable and, in fact, essential thing, and I don't expect it to decline. In more recent years, there was discussion on revising it, and now a revised Hanyu is being developed that will go in 5 volumes when it's completed. The fourth, down to the fourth volume, will be published within a couple of years from now.
Mm.
But a fifth volume, I don't know, that may be a bit longer.
But in fact, did all the three languages that we are concerned with at Griffith, Chinese, Japanese and Indonesian...
Now we should add Korean, of course.
Korean, of course, yes.
But that's only very recent.
Did they go out from the private schools into the state schools?
Chinese certainly did in Queensland. I think not Japanese. Japanese had already been introduced in several, both private and state schools.
I see.
Indonesian, that was both as well, actually. Mm-hmm. But it was a long time. You're quite right about the private schools for Chinese, because it was a long time before even one state school took it up.
Mm.
That wasn't until, the 80s, really. It was eight years.
When we were doing the... Chinese and Indonesian language contests for school children here at Griffith. On one occasion, George Barclay, who was then Director General of Education in Queensland, was coming to open it, and I walked down to meet him, and as we walked along back to the central theatres, he said to me, is Chinese taught in state schools in Queensland? And I said, well, I'm sorry, at the moment... I think there are only one or two. Largely, it's in private schools.
That's right. That's
and
right.
I think he took quite a concerned interest in that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also that, you were responsible for approaches to the Queensland government, weren't you, and other people.
In the very early days.
In the very early days, yes, to encourage them to...
And others too, but I remember taking a leading thing on that.
Do you have a rough idea of what the enrolment in the School of Modern Asian Studies was when teaching began at Griffith in 75?
I do. I'll never forget. It was 93 students came as full-timers in
93.
And part-time, we had a part-time course then which tried to do very similar things at half the pace. That there were 28 students, I think we had then. It was 28 or 30.
Part-time.
Part-time students, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they were people who had jobs.
And those part-timers.
So largely they were mature age people.
Yeah, most of
them. Yes.
Uh-huh. The younger ones, the full-timers, only a proportion were. But I remember Paul Healy was one of them, who's done very well, as I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. Greg Storey was one of the first year, 1975.
Mm-hmm.
And another one that came in 1975, who was a very young and who later became my secretary, Wendy.
Oh, yes, yes.
She's now called Wendy Smith. And what was her name? No, I've forgotten. If it doesn't matter. How can I forget that?
Oh, well, it's very easy. I mean, you've all called her Wendy for years and
right.
forgotten about the
That's right.
the surname.
But she married while she was my secretary.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So it was really good to have her back, too.
Yes.
When I was dean.
What was the relative popularity of the languages taught at that stage?
Yes. Now, in the first year, we had only Chinese.
Ah, yes.
In the second year, when we added Japanese and Indonesian, it was still Chinese was the most popular.
Mm-hmm.
In the very earliest years after that, it tended to fluctuate from time to time. Sometimes it was, you know, once or twice Indonesian the most popular, Chinese, Japanese. However, after a few years, Japanese established itself as the most popular, and quite substantially so, and has remained so more or less ever since.
In fact, not more or less, completely. One of the reasons for that is the tremendous amount of economic exchange between Japan and Australia and the tremendous influx of Japanese tourists.
In 1989, the numbers doing Chinese, well, in 1990, following the crisis in China in 1989, the numbers dropped very greatly, but they've begun to recover now.
Oh,
in fact, they've more than begun.
That's good, because it's very important, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, after all, the birth control business didn't do much good in China, did it?
Yeah.
1.3 billion, I think I heard the other 1.
day. 1.133 billion now.
1.133.
That's the 1990, according to the 1990 census. Although it's a bit more now, 1.16. But it's still going up. I mean, it would have gone up much quicker, though,
without the birth control.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
it's very difficult to do anything about the country, though, isn't it? It's the people in the countryside that...
Mm.
I suppose they're still peasants.
Mm. A lot of them are, yeah.
Yes. With the old...
Yes, it's a very, very difficult problem, that one.
...idea that the sons are so important, and it's very important to have...
Don't know how you change that.
I mean, no, something's... Read into centuries and centuries.
Mm.
How were Asian studies regarded in Australia at the period of, when teaching began here? And how were they regarded in Queensland?
I'd say that they were not particularly well regarded. In Australia as a whole, or in Queensland in particular.
Mm-hmm.
1975 was our first year of teaching, and that was the last of the Whitlam years. Whitlam had begun an approach to, you know, really focusing our foreign policy in towards Asia, but only on a rather small basis, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And the impact on the study of Asia was still very, very slight. Very slight. And it was definitely a pioneering move on Ted Brayer's part and those who gave birth to the School of Modern Asian Studies,
mm-hmm.
that this focus on Asia. As for Queensland, I would say that Queensland had more focus on Japan than the other countries of Asia, partly because of the trade. Queensland is a source of minerals,
mm-hmm.
and that was of great interest to the Queensland government.
Mm-hmm.
Also because Queensland, it was politically more suitable for the Queensland government, which was very conservative at that time,
mm-hmm.
Than China,
mm.
and or indeed Indonesia.
Mm.
And the Queensland government... And the Australian government wasn't very keen on Asian studies. I mean, the curriculum there was a curriculum development corporation they had, which did continue to exist throughout the Fraser years,
mm-hmm.
Which it was prepared to look at Asian studies, but it never really gave it a focus. I remember having a big fight with them over... Well, it wasn't exactly a fight, but I wanted to...
An argument.
Yeah, an argument. I wanted to develop some materials for music.
Oh,
and yes. I did, in fact, do so.
Yes.
I wrote one on China. I edited a whole series. We had meetings. We had Japan. We had one in Korea. We had one in the Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia.
Oh, yes, I remember those.
We had a whole series of them.
Yes.
And, I mean, I don't think very many people used them, but they were there in those early days.
Yes.
That was the Curriculum Development Corporation. I edited it.
Yes.
And so, I mean, there was some work done, but I think if you compare that with the years since 1986, the Asian Studies Council really has made a very big difference. And so I would say my short answer to your question is how were Asian Studies regarded in Australia at that time? Not very highly.
Mm.
I think the idea that Asian studies were as important as European studies would have been regarded with outright suspicion and a bit of ridicule by most people.
Yes. Isn't it extraordinary? And you're one of the pioneers of it. And the School of Modern Asian Studies is a pioneer body, to try and encourage people to become interested in Asia.
Yeah.
And you had all that opposition at the beginning, and you have to fight all the way to to do something which is now recognised and on a government level is being made use of.
That's right. Yep.
Were the academic staff in MAS involved in any extracurricular activities to encourage interest in MAS?
Now, yes.
Particularly in the schools, but, you know,
they were.
Elsewhere, yes.
I remember going around schools in general, trying to encourage them to come to Griffith in general and Asian Studies in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Many times going to the schools, you know. And then, as you'll remember, we had a program of trying to develop weekend sessions about Asia.
Yeah, seminars.
Seminars.
Mm.
Inviting people in different parts of Queensland.
Mm-hmm. And then you travelled, didn't you?
We travelled, yes.
For instance, I think there was one in Bundaberg.
There was,
there?
Yes. I remember driving to Bundaberg.
Yes.
With Bob Walton.
Yes, yes.
We drove up and there was one a little later. There was one, Nancy Viviani and I and a couple of others too. We flew to Bundaberg, yeah. Mackay we went to. Toowoomba. Several times. Ipswich, do you remember that one in Ipswich? Yes.
That was a very good one at the Girls' Grammar School.
Yes,
wasn't
that's
it?
Right, in 1981.
Yes.
1981, it was, yeah.
Mm.
And down the Gold Coast, do you remember that?
Yes, yes, I do.
We gave talks to people, we had seminars, we encouraged questions.
Yeah.
Looking back on it, I think it probably was worth it. I was often disappointed at the
response.
The response.
Yes, so was I.
From people. But, I mean, I don't regret having done any of that.
No.
And I think, you said we're the academic staff. I've talked about myself mostly, I suppose. But, I mean, many others did this.
Mm.
Colin Brown was very active in doing it. Edmund Fung helped, I remember.
Julia Howell.
Julia Howell was another, yeah.
And I think Paul Ivory, too.
Paul Ivory, yes. Several of them did.
And also they were speaking at meetings, at seminars that other people organised.
That's right.
And they were asked to give an address on some specific aspect of modern Asian studies.
Indeed.
Mm. Yes, so it's been really an all-out effort.
Mm.
As a student, I was conscious of a caring attitude toward the students in MAS. How did the system of personal tutors arise? And is this continued today?
Now, the system of personal tutors arose because the university as a whole, John Willett, and I think, well, certainly I agreed with it very strongly, was very keen to have a close relationship between the teachers and the students as part of a good education.
Mm-hmm.
We thought that it was very important for a good education. And I remember in the very early days of the university, in fact, even until the 80s, I used to make a point of remembering everybody's name and being on, you know, personal terms, with good personal terms, with as many as I possibly could. I think I did that more than the others, but I was not the only one to take an effort to be on, you know, good terms with the students. It was part of our policy, in fact it still is part of the policy of the university, although I think it may change, to have common rooms that did not differentiate between students and staff. Mm-hmm. And that meant that whenever you went for a cup of coffee, you could talk to students, yes, you know, get to know them. We had a very carefully worked out orientation week, which tried to develop good relations, and you could get friendly with them. That's how the system arose. I think it was a very good system. It became more difficult when the number of students got greater.
Yes.
It just became so much work to have one person in charge of the foundation course, and that has now been abandoned. Mm-hmm. In MAS, as in other schools, you have it's much more broken up, and it's not really encouraged anymore to have such close relations,
mm-hmm.
partly because it's so difficult and everybody's so busy and there are so many students. It's lost that personal touch, I think. I think it was a pity that should be the case. Anyway, that's how it arose, and I think that was a good system. Is it continued today? Well, I suppose to some extent it's not really.
Not really. What used to happen, quite apart from the personal tutors, you'd have a lecture, and then the lecturer and all the students would go down to the common room, mm. and you'd sit around having coffee and continuing having an argument or discussion whatever.
Mm. In the second and third year, I mean, I still do that in my third year course on Chinese politics.
Do you?
Mm. I break in the middle.
Oh, yes.
And then go and have coffee with the students, talk to them and so on. I still know every student in my Chinese politics course, but in the foundation course it's just not possible anymore.
No, the numbers are... big isn't beautiful. Mm. Small, I think, was quite beautiful. Mm. But big had to come.
Yeah.
When did the first visits from Griffith to Asian countries begin, and who went on these visits? Now, I don't mean the exchanges, but the visits.
Well, look, we're the first one to China, and I think that was the first one organised from... wasn't so necessary for Japan and Indonesia because it was easier for people to just travel on their own. But I will never forget the first time that the one to China was. It was in January 1977. Edmund Fung and I took a group of students. There were about 15 students. They were drawn from the MAS students, especially those who were interested in China. And since it was there were mainly third-year students. In fact, I think they were all third-year students at that stage. And they were very enthusiastic. And I remember we went through great debate to choose them. We had a selection, even though they had to pay, of course, to go. Mm-hmm. There was quite heavy competition to go.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Guangzhou, Shanghai, and various other places, Beijing, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Wuxi, near Shanghai, and to Hangzhou.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very pleasant, even though it was bitterly cold. I'll never forget it because it was... We were in doubt, even to quite late, whether we'd be able to go.
It was the Christmas period, was it?
Just after Christmas, January.
Yes. Yeah.
And that 77 was such an important year because it was the year after the fall of the Gang of Four.
Oh, yes.
And China was in something of a crisis.
Yes.
And we didn't know how serious at the time. I mean, we knew it was in crisis. We knew Mao had just died.
Mm.
We knew that all right.
Mm.
But, the organising of that thing, to get... It was worth it, though. It was very good. Mm. I think the students really enjoyed it.
Yes.
I can remember some of those who went on. Wendy was one of them, whom I've already mentioned.
Yes.
There were a number of... Matthew Curtis was one of those who went.
Mm-hmm.
And Annabelle Chaplin, Derek Jaffa.
Aldith Graves, did she go?
Aldith didn't.
Didn't.
No, she didn't go.
Mm-hmm.
But there were, that was very good.
Mm. And they did continue, didn't they?
There were a few others after that, but we discontinued them after a few years. We didn't have one the following year, but then the year after there was another one.
Mm-hmm.
And the Vice-Chancellor took a group.
Yes.
John took it, and so did John Topley, the registrar at that time.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He went with one of them,
mm-hmm.
And he enjoyed it. And John Willett and I both took one. That was the last one, in fact. Mm-hmm. We both took one, another group. Mm-hmm. He was the former leader, of course, of being the Vice-Chancellor, and, yes. But I went as well. Mm-hmm. And we had a very pleasant time. So did Bob Ross went that time too.
Oh, yes. Mm. Yeah.
Head of CULT. Mm. That was very good and very worthwhile. I don't regret any of that.
No. How did the intercountry exchange programs for students begin? I think you were involved in particularly in the...
Well, I was for the China ones.
Yeah. Yes.
When I became dean in 1979, we called it chairman then, the first time after that, the first winter after that, was the winter that John Willett and I went to... I think that was the one that we went to China together.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed on while the others went. I stayed on to do research
mm-hmm.
on Chinese drama for a book which I subsequently published. And I visited, with his approval, I visited three universities, which were the Beijing Foreign Studies University in Beijing, where I had long contacts.
Mm-hmm.
Since the 60s, when I taught there from 64 to 66.
Oh.
Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou and Sichuan University in Chengdu, capital of Sichuan. Of those three, two of those exchanges, which I set up then, have continued to this day.
Guangzhou?
Sun Yat-sen and the Beijing Foreign Studies University.
Oh.
We have sent students every year to those two universities, including 1989, when the crisis was on.
Mm.
Every single year, hasn't been one missed.
That's
and they still go, and they have sent people back here too.
They have.
For exchange.
About how many? Half a dozen? Or not as many as that?
Not as... Well, there would... Yes, there'd be about half a dozen have come back. But we reached an arrangement that they stayed longer, and they've always sent staff rather than students.
Whereas
we've focused on the students.
Mm.
And it hasn't been quite as successful coming back, because in the case of the Sun Yat-sen University, they've all been scientists, and a number of them haven't gone back to China, which is a pity in my view.
Well, it is, isn't it? I mean, the reason they do these things are to help the country, the country that they come from.
And that's right. Well,
but it's understandable, I suppose.
It is understandable, yes.
Mm. And over the years, how many countries has MAS been involved in these exchanges?
With China, Japan, Indonesia,
uh-huh.
and more latterly with Korea.
Oh, good.
And there are attempts being made to set up with Taiwan as well.
Oh,
now,
fine.
Actually, from the very earliest years, Elizabeth Jiang, who was in the Language Centre and later joined the School of MAS, she organised for students in quite large numbers to go to Taiwan to learn, improve their Chinese, and many have been on that.
Mm.
And that's been very productive and very worthwhile too, I think.
Mm, very good. Mm. Have academic staff exchange programs taken place, and with which countries?
Now, as far as academic staff is concerned, that's been much less. Academic staff have been to Asia many, many times,
mm-hmm.
but not really on the exchange programs. We've focused on the students with exchange programs. And recently there's been a couple of attempts to get staff to go over to Asian countries on exchange programs. But it's very difficult to manage in the sense that people want to go to Asia for their particular reasons. They want to do their particular research or their particular projects.
And they don't want to fit into the pattern there.
Yes, and it often doesn't fit into a pattern. So that's been quite difficult to organise on the whole.
I remember Mary-Ann Farquhar went
to the University of Sichuan on that. Yeah, was not really on the exchange. I suppose you could say it was on the exchange, but she did. She went to the university, and I did too, actually.
And Kevin Bucknell.
That's right.
Yes.
He did.
Mm.
I don't know that your school... I suppose Kevin was... Yeah, he was on the exchange, really. I'm not sure that he'd consider himself on the exchange.
It was a sort of introduction thing, really. What he wanted to do there.
That's right. I mean, for instance, when I went, I didn't consider myself as being on the exchange. I wanted to go there because that was
an area that you wanted
I was interested in.
Research, yes. Mm.
But Mary was very close to the Chinese scholar who came here. Whose name I've forgotten, He? Was she surnamed He? I've forgotten her name. She came here and spent some time. Sukhan Jackson went on the exchange.
Ah, yes.
But I'm afraid it didn't last.
Wang Jiaxiang, of course.
Wang Jiaxiang came from, she was from the Beijing Foreign Studies University.
Yes.
She came, and there were several others too. She was the first one to come.
Yes.
Mm. And she's remained a long-term friend of mine.
Has she?
Mm. I knew her back in the 60s. And I still.
Did you? Before she
I still see her every time I go.
Oh, that's great. Was there, or has there been a successful program for Asian academics coming to Griffith to obtain higher degrees? Well, Wang Jiaxiang would be one.
She was one, but unfortunately the exchange programs haven't been particularly successful in terms of getting degrees. And the reason for that is because the government made it very difficult to allow Asian students to do courses unless they paid.
Oh, I see.
It's quite soon it became a...
That's the federal government. Yes.
It became a sort of... payment thing. Mm. And so what we tended to do to counter that was just get them not to do degrees.
I see.
And that was a pity. It meant that they came, but they didn't... And they
had the experience.
They studied, yeah.
But they didn't...
they didn't do degrees.
Get the piece of paper that gave them a title.
That's right. For example, Yu Jian. You remember him? He's now a professor at the Beijing Foreign Studies University. He came here. And he had a very good time, I think, but he didn't get a qualification from it. He learned a lot.
Yes.
He learned an enormous amount. Mm. And he's since done very well in Australian studies. He's written books and takes courses and things like that.
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that the degrees are, the most important thing.
They're not.
The study is the most important thing, isn't it? And the learning and the knowledge you acquire.
Mm.
What sort of relationship has there been between MAS, or AIS as it now is, and the Australian government?
I'd say a fairly good one. Many of our graduates have gone into the government service.
Mm-hmm.
And the courses that we had, I think, were approved by the Australian government for that purpose. For example, the idea of combining the study of an Asian language with the study of an Asian country with exchange programs and with a course on Australia and Asia, Australian Asian relations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was the first of the integrating courses that we had. It was introduced in 1977. It wasn't very good at first, I must admit that, but it was the first integrating courses to be introduced, and it got much better, especially after Nancy arrived,
yes.
Nancy Viviani.
I did it after she arrived.
You did it after. Was
yes.
it good then?
Yes, yes.
She,
fascinating.
Because that was her special field, and she's an excellent teacher.
Mm.
And she was the director of the Centre for the Study of Australian Asian Relations, which we still have.
Yes.
And she was the first director of that, appointed specifically for the purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And that was excellent.
Mm.
And I think that particular combination of courses was very attractive to people in the field of in the extreme government. I think it still is, actually. Even now, it's the same.
Mr. Hayden, when he was Deputy Prime Minister or Minister for Foreign Affairs, I can't remember which, or it might have been Treasurer, but he was very conscious of the good work that Griffith was doing in the
Foreign
Asian
Affairs,
area.
Department of Foreign Affairs.
Foreign Affairs, yes.
He was the Minister of Foreign Affairs for
he came
one.
To address us on a couple of occasions, and he was really most laudatory in the things that he said about...
he was quite remarkable, actually. In fact, he still is remarkable.
Yes.
He's got a very good, very personal touch, you know. He likes to do things himself rather than getting... underlings to do it and bureaucrats to do it. I'll never forget, I was most surprised. One day I went to see David Lim. I was the dean then.
Yes.
And there was Hayden sitting in David Lim's office.
Yes. Yeah, unannounced. And
completely unannounced.
Yes.
He'd just come.
Yes.
I think actually when John Willett found that out, he wasn't very pleased because that he was the Minister of Foreign Affairs then. Or was he? Yes. Or was he the? I think he was the Minister of Foreign Affairs at that time.
Probably, yes. Well, David Lim had been appointed to the Jackson Committee, which was considering the Australian Government Committee, which was considering a foreign aid.
Mm.
Wasn't he?
That was probably the reason.
And yes, Mr. Hayden was involved in that. I think, in fact, he'd appointed him to it.
Mm. What other things can one say about the Australian government? John Willett was a member of the Australia-China Council for some time, but you said MAS or AIS.
Mm.
I don't think there are any members of MAS or AIS that were. I was a member of the Asian Studies Council, but only rather briefly.
Mm-hmm.
From 1986, I was only there for a year or so towards the end of its life.
Mm-hmm.
David was a member of several government committees.
Mm-hmm.
So I think overall, you could say we've had a good relationship with the Australian government.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're quite well regarded there. I mean, I suppose you'd have to ask them to know how they regard us, but. We've certainly tried to maintain good relations, and the
establishment. Try to educate the Australian government.
Well, indeed, yes. Yes. And the fact that the key centre for Asian languages, the first key centre for Asian languages and studies, we're only part of it, admittedly. This University of Queensland as well.
Oh.
But I mean, I think that says something.
Yes,
I hope it does.
How did the Centre for Australian Asian Relations actually begin? Whose idea was that? How did it come about?
Now, that's a good question. I think it was primarily Jim Jackson's idea, actually. He was the dean. He was the chairman at the time.
Yes.
He had only a very short chairmanship.
Yes.
Because he died of a brain hemorrhage.
Tragic.
Very tragic. Mm. He died late in 1978, or was it early 79? I can't remember. He was chairman only for a year.
Mm.
And it was while he was chairman that the idea was taken up. It was enthusiastically supported by John Willett, Colin Brown and me,
mm-hmm.
and I think Edmund Fung as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the one who sort of steered it into, you know, who sort of got it going.
Mm-hmm.
Although I remember interviewing Nancy in Jim's office when he was still dean.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one who took the primary move for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I became dean in 1979 and encouraged it greatly. And I had a very, very good relationship with Nancy,
mm-hmm.
which I still have, actually,
mm-hmm.
A sort of lifelong friendship, which is
yes.
which has really been so good and I value so much, and I hope she does too.
I'm sure she does.
And So that's really how it got going, and it was, with Nancy and so on, with support from me, it really went from strength to strength. And after she left, she went to take up a chair at the Australian National University. Colin Brown and others, and I mean, I wasn't, David Lim and so on was then, but it's still doing very well, and it's still been very productive.
It was supported financially, wasn't it?
By the Australian government. Yes.
So, they obviously realised the value
they
of it.
They did indeed, yeah.
Yes.
Mm.
And then it was renewed again. There was a review of the whole CSER activities.
That's right, yes. And then it was decided
that they would continue to finance it.
Nancy was so energetic.
Yes.
Really so energetic.
Mm.
She wrote so much and she got, people writing things and really made quite an impression, a very big impression.
And I think perhaps one other question, unless you have some that you'd like to, provide answers for, the questions and answers. Has the school, now the faculty, been successful in obtaining research grants?
Overall, I think it's not done too badly. There have been some reasonably good grants in terms of research and other things. In the early days, it was not as good as it's later become. And what will happen from now on, I don't know, but there are several big ARC grants that have been just announced, like one for Bob Elson, for example, who's been very good at research.
Oh, great. That's,
And I think if one looks at the whole period, it's been good, but I don't know that it's been outstanding compared with, say, the science and humanities and other, even other places in Asian studies. But if you were to extend that to not only research grants but sort of grants in general, which include research grants, of course, some of the biggest ones that I can think of, well, the Centre for the Study of Australian Asian Relations was a major one. Another one is the Dragon's Tongue Chinese Language ABC the project that I did with the ABC. We got, the Asian Studies Council gave us about, exactly $400,000 for that, which is quite a large amount of money. And which is successful. I mean, it's
highly successful, wasn't it?
It's gone to, and it's going to go to air again next year.
Is it? Good.
And we've compiled all kinds of subsidiary materials like scripts and audio tapes and also curriculum support materials. All that's been done now, and it'll be... So that project is only now actually reaching total fruition. And that was a grant we got. The Key Centre also has been a substantial grant. That's for 7 years. We've got this outside of the Key Centre. Our program has got 155,000 plus equipment, money from 88, 88, 9 and up to now, and will be until the end of 94 at least, and possibly even longer than that. So that's from the Australian Research, from the DEET, so that's a government grant. And then, I mean, there have been several of the scholars of the AIS have got good grants for doing research, their own research projects. I know Julia Howell has got a good one do on religion.
Oh, good.
Edmund Fung got one. I've got a couple of few. And, of course, Edmund and I had a joint project to do a book on Australia-China relations. We were given grants from the Australia-China Council to do that. And we did, completed, so that was done. So, I mean, I think overall we haven't done too badly. Where have we been successful in obtaining research grants? Let's say in obtaining grants, I think we've done quite well.
Yes. Colin, I don't know that we've touched on the matter of the people doing higher degrees. You've had quite a good program of higher degree students in MAS and, well, in AIS. Altogether, haven't you?
I think we've had a good program, yes. Quite a few of our own graduates have gone on to do.
Worth repeating that question, Patience?
About the postgraduate. When?
Right now.
Oh, thank you. We haven't talked, I think, about higher degrees students in AIS. Did you... you did have quite a good collection of people doing higher degrees.
I'd say we did, and have, and still have. The higher degrees... many of the graduates of our own school went on to do higher degrees, and some of the most successful, in fact, have been in that category. I mean, Michael Dutton, I've already mentioned, Paul Healy, and
John
Hannafin.
Hannafin
went on to do it, although I don't know what he's doing recently. I haven't heard from him for quite a long time, actually. But we still have that. I mean, for example, Stacey Bush is one that we've done. We've got... She did an honours degree, and she's doing a PhD now, and there are quite a few others.
Yes.
Of those that we've attracted from outside, there have been quite a few. They have mainly, I'd say, been all a lot from Asia. A lot of them have been from Asia, especially from the countries involved, like in Indonesia, for example. Quite a few Chinese have come to study Chinese studies. You know, matters connected with China. The university still has a major scholarship system, which is, but it's very difficult for people to come from outside because they have to pay quite a lot nowadays. Under the
Nasrul Islam came over from Bangladesh.
He still corresponds. Do you hear from him from time to time?
No, I don't. No, I've had a couple of letters from him, but I haven't heard from him lately.
I had a letter a few months ago. He still seems to be doing reasonably well. I think his children have grown up now.
He's a professor at his university. Yes, he's back to professorship. But he had a partial scholarship, didn't he?
Yes. And I think he was also supported by his
own government. Government or university. And this brought quite a flavour to Asian studies, didn't it, with people from other countries like this coming here with their families and doing their higher degrees at Griffith. Because there was a social contact as well.
That's right.
I remember I went a couple of times to functions that Nasrul Islam had in his home, you entertained me and with Nasrul and his wife and family before they went back again.
That's right. If I were to, you said, were there any other themes? If I was looking back on the whole experience of Griffith University, and especially the early days, I think that it's been a very rewarding experience.
I'm sure it has.
One thing that I does stand out in my mind is an enormous amount of hard work.
Yes.
It's just been a real slog in the sense of I've always wanted to be involved in the teaching and in the administration and in doing my own research. Those three aspects which I sort of came to think as being the three things that academics should do. I recall having a lot of, you know, a very heavy teaching load, both of undergraduate and postgraduate. I have enjoyed it, I must say. I've enjoyed it enormously because I get a lot of satisfaction out of you know, seeing how people respond to things and debating and arguing and discussing issues with students. And it's for that reason, I guess, I've always been very keen to do the tutorials myself in a course rather than leaving them to tutors. And I still think that. Although I haven't, my teaching has been much less in the last few years than before. I suppose largely because I'm not involved in the foundation course anymore, which I was heavily involved in the early years, heavily in that. I still have my own course on Chinese politics, and I still take part in his courses on historiography and so on, but I have much fewer than I used to. In terms of administration also, apart from the Key Centre, I have much less than I used to. But I was very keen to help, to be involved in the administration. When I was dean for 6 years, which was from 79 to 85, that was the time of working hardest, I guess, because the being dean really takes it out of you. I wouldn't want to do it again, I can tell you.
No.
It really takes it out of you. You've got to be on the spot all the time. You've got to be... People complain to you all the time if they don't get what they want.
Yes.
And the staffing, it's very, very harrowing and very draining. Or perhaps draining is a better word than harrowing.
Yes.
Trying to keep people happy and trying to give people, be fair to everybody and keep the teaching going at the same time. I remember finding, in fact, that the teaching was a bit of a relief because for some of that administration.
Yes.
And then keeping the research going at the same time, trying to do keep out the books and things like that and scholarly articles, keeping hand in terms of what's been happening in the profession and so on. So, I mean, I look back on it as a lot of hard work, but not the sort of hard work that I would sort of regret. I mean, I think it's been good on the whole.
The committee system at Griffith is very time-consuming, isn't it?
It's very time-consuming. Yeah. It's been in a bit of decline lately, I think, but there are still many committees. It's declined in the sense that you don't do things quite as much by committee as used to be the case. Uh-huh. But it's still, the main decisions are still made through committees. And it's still, you know, you still have the committee structures in the faculties. We still have admissions committees and honours board, all that sort of thing. Yes. It decides on things and staff committee, which decide on staffing matters and things of that sort. So it hasn't basically changed. Still remains in place. But I suppose I think this is a good university. I've always thought that. I don't know whether it's as good a university as it was in the sense that sense of commitment I think I perceive as having declined, and the sense of collegial esprit de corps, you might say, I think is weaker. But I think that is inevitable when a university gets as big as this one has now got.
Yeah.
In some ways it's a pity. But I suppose there's no use, as our foreign minister has recently said, there's no use kicking against the pricks. You have to go with the times.
Yes.
And the times point in a larger things with less personal relations. And I think that if you consider, I mean, we don't have the same number of intimate functions that we used to have. I mean, for example, I remember when we first started this university, I remember I used to invite the students to my home on quite a regular basis. And
Elizabeth Chang did
as well.
And
that was sort of taken for granted as something that was good, but I don't think people do that now.
Don't they?
I don't think so.
Oh, that's a shame, because it added a great deal of to the atmosphere of Griffith. Mm.
You came, for example, to my
house. Yes, I did.
And it did. It added a lot of atmosphere. We used to have barbecues with the students.
Yes.
Very rare now. I can't remember the last time I had barbecue with the students, actually.
And they used to be on campus, didn't they?
Mm.
And they don't have them on campus now.
Very rare.
Oh, what a pity.
It is a pity, yeah.
Well,
obviously,
tremendous amount of work that you went through. I mean, all the things that you did. I don't know whether there's more work today. Do you think there is a different kind of work? Is that what's making it difficult for people to?
It's busy.
Have the social.
It's a different kind of work, but it's just as busy. Yeah.
More bureaucratic work.
More bureaucratic. Yes. But I mean, I found the Key Centre just as busy as before.
Yes.
I never seemed to have really time for really serious rest.
You're director of the Key Centre, aren't you?
Yeah.
Is that the correct term? The
director? Co-director. Because there's another one at the University of Queensland, Alan Ricks,
yes. Who used to be with us, yes.
And he was the director of centre, the CESA, for a while as well. But I find, for example, I'm much less involved with students now than I used to be.
Yes, and I know you regret that, because you always used to like your involvement with students, and I think they appreciated it.
Well, I hope so.
Well, thank you very much, Colin. I've thoroughly enjoyed this.
Well, I have too.
I'm sure it's going to...
thank you very much. I hope you can find some useful material and all that.
Certainly there will be.
For the project. Good.
Thank you.